The problem is, you do see a lot of antisocial people succeed. Loneliness is this bigger risk factor for ill health and death.
You know, we live inside our heads.
You go cold turkey, you go into withdrawal.
There's a lot of value in the stuff that we struggle with.
Better Thinking, conversations with experts exploring all things psychology. Welcome back to Better Thinking. My name is Nesh Nikolic, and my guest today is John Sweller, and he's here to talk to us about cognitive load theory. John Sweller is an educational psychologist and emeritus professor at the University of New South Wales. He received a PhD from the University of Adelaide's Department of Psychology in 1972. He's best known for formulating cognitive load theory, which uses our knowledge of evolutionary psychology and human cognitive architecture as a base for instructional design. The theory is one of the most highly cited educational psychology theories, and it is a contributor to both research and debate on issues associated with human cognition, its links to evolution by natural selection, and the instructional consequences that follow. Based on hundreds of randomized control studies carried out by many investigators from around the globe, cognitive load theory has generated a large range of novel instructional procedures. John has authored over 200 academic publications, and he is a fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia. It was an immense pleasure to talk to John about cognitive load theory, it's the understanding of cognitive architecture, and how this can inform the delivery of psychological therapy. After speaking with John, I've decided to change my practice to ensure my clients come away with more from each session. There is a lot to be understood and I believe followed up on from this conversation. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I have in interviewing John. John, a big thank you for coming onto the program today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here.
Look, I'm very excited to be speaking to you. I know that your work that commenced many years ago, decades ago, in actual fact, looking at cognitive load theory is as applicable today as it was when you set out on this adventure. As a psychologist, I am always looking for how can I leave a message in the room that is as sticky as possible, that goes away with the clients, that they can take the message away, that it's practical, that it's practical, and hopefully they're able to use it. That's the name of the game. So I'm really eager to find out about cognitive load theory, understand the architecture of the mind, the brain, the limitations, and how we can use this understanding in informing, you know, instructional design. How do I, deliver these messages? I personally am a pretty well married to acceptance and commitment therapy. And so what that means for me is that we use lots of metaphors. We use lots of stories. And there's an understanding, at least in the method, that that is an element of being sticky, but I would love to hear more about this from someone so learned as you, as to whether this is a true understanding and the research supported by research or not. But let's get started at the very beginning. How did you come across wanting to understand these limits and developing this cognitive load theory, and obviously where that's then fall into all the other space of, you know, cognitive architecture and informing instructional design?
The theory has been under continuous development by me and by a large number of colleagues, both here in Australia and overseas. It began many decades ago when I was studying problem solving, and I noticed that people could solve problems. They could readily solve problems. And frequently, once they'd solved the problem, they realized, good, I've got to a solution. But they also realized, I've no idea how I really did that. And for anyone who, for example, has as a hobby solving puzzle problems, they'll know the feeling. You know, you can work at it and you can work at it. Sometimes you can work at it for hours and you finally get there and, oh dear, how did I do that? And I realized, look, that's important, and that means something, especially you know, when you're presenting information to people, you can present the information, they can understand it, and they can easily lose sight of what the character of that information is, what it really means, what one really should do with it. And they lose sight of it because of the characteristics of human cognitive architecture. We've got a working memory which processes initial novel information. And it's a peculiar structure in that it's extremely limited, both in amount of information that it can hold and the time it can hold it. We can process something like 2, 3, maybe 4 items of information simultaneously if it's novel information. We can hold it in working memory for no more than about 20 seconds or so. And after that, it's gone. And one wonders under those circumstances, well, how do we learn anything? How do we ever acquire information? And the answer is, once we've processed information through our working memory, if we want to retain it, we can retain it in long-term memory. And long-term memory, unlike working memory, has no known limits. One assumes there must be limits somewhere, but whatever they are, we don't know what they are. Furthermore, the limits of working memory that I've just been talking about, they completely disappear when we're dealing with familiar information taken from long-term memory. Okay, the limits I talked about before, they only apply to novel information. They don't apply to familiar information that we're taking from long-term memory. That means that once something has gone into long-term memory, we're transformed. We become different people. We can do things, we can think about things that we couldn't possibly consider before the information had gone into long-term memory. So the ultimate purpose of any communication that requires somebody to learn something is that information needs to go into long-term memory. Simply being processed by working memory is not enough. Hence the term cognitive load theory. We're concerned with organizing information in a manner that makes it easier to process in working memory and then transfer the information into long-term memory. And there are procedures for doing that. And that's the ultimate basis for cognitive load theory. It keeps developing as new information comes along. To give you an example, a relatively recent example, we've learned a lot more about cognition over the years. And one of the things we've learned is that there are two categories of information that we need to distinguish between. And they've been called by David Geary, an American psychologist, biologically primary and biologically secondary information. Biologically primary information is information we've evolved to acquire over many, many generations. We can acquire it easily, effortlessly, unconsciously. Learning how to listen to and speak our native language, which is probably the most complex thing most people do. It's really complex. We don't find it complex. We don't actually teach people how to acquire their native language. You can see that in the, if you had to teach somebody how to organize their mouth, their lips, their tongue, their voice, their breath in order to speak, you couldn't do it.
No.
Speech pathologists learn how to do it, but the rest of us don't. We don't need to. We don't set up schools that teach people how to do that. It's an immensely complex thing, but we've evolved to be able to learn to listen to and speak our native language. We haven't evolved to specifically learn to read and write. And you can see the difference in that since the beginning of humans, we've been able to listen and speak our native language. It's only been in about last, oh, I don't know, about 150 years or so that most people could read and write. Before then, reading and writing was invented several thousand years ago. And during most of that period, only a tiny proportion of any population could read and write. Mass education changed that, and without education, most people don't learn to read and write. A few do, very, very few, but most don't.
Mm.
And that's the difference between biologically primary and biologically secondary information. Now, the human cognitive architecture that I was talking about before, the limited working memory, long-term memory, those characteristics apply to biologically secondary information. And schools were invented precisely because without them, biologically secondary information, which we, the most advanced societies, is a requirement. So when you talk about using stories, for example, to communicate with the people you're dealing with, that's important because that's using biologically primary information. Humans are good at listening to and understanding and acquiring stories. We've evolved to do that. And if you can attach biologically secondary information that people haven't acquired automatically and it's information they need, attach them to stories, they'll be able to acquire more of the information. In other words, you can use biologically primary skills to leverage the acquisition of secondary skills.
Mm-hmm.
And the human cognitive architecture that I talked about earlier, limited working memory, unlimited long-term memory, all of that applies to biologically secondary information. Biologically primary information, every type of it has its own cognitive architecture, and in a way it's something we don't need to consider very much because we've evolved to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
But secondary information we do need to consider. When you talk to people, you're essentially telling them things they don't know. If it was biologically primary, they'd know it because they just pick it up automatically. The reason you have patients approaching you is because they correctly feel, look, you've got information that I need and I don't know, and this person is going to help me acquire that information and change whatever behaviors need changing. So that's a brief summary. There's a lot more to it, but it's a brief summary of cognitive load theory.
Let me ask a psychological question within this, which is when novel information is presented, you mentioned that there is a 20-second limit that it can be held by the working memory, and there's a certain amount of information that can be held also. So there's a limit on that.
Yes.
We're obviously trying as a clinician to move it from the working memory to the long-term memory.
Exactly.
Because those limits then don't apply afterwards. What is the understanding of how it moves? Because I have a follow-up question, but what's the understanding of how it moves from working memory to long-term memory?
Okay. Look, that's not something we need to give a great deal of consideration, the process, because that's biologically primary.
Okay, so that just happened. Okay.
Yeah. That will happen automatically, but we can make it easier by, well, one way is just practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, repetition.
Repetition. It's like a telephone number. You may recall the old telephone numbers before mobile phones. They tended to be 6 or 7 digits and no more than that. There was a good reason for that. You could hold that in working memory. The new mobile numbers that we have,
sure,
they're much more difficult to deal with. But with respect, that's for a novel telephone number. Some numbers you know. Okay, you know, you remember your own number because it's in long-term memory.
Yes.
Once it's in long-term memory, then the problems don't arise. Now, how does it come into long-term memory? Well, one way is repetition. If you keep working on a particular something in particular, then that something will eventually go into long-term memory. And again, we don't have to do anything in particular to transfer it from working memory to long-term memory. It will just happen as a biologically primary skill. We don't have to teach people how to do it.
And John, can I ask a question around repetition? I would assume that repetition over time, meaning if we examine a particular way of thinking in session 1 and then session 2 and then session 3, periods of time have passed, there's repetition in that. From my understanding of the literature, at least within psychology, is that there is a strong preference toward weekly sessions over fortnightly sessions in terms of therapeutic outcomes. So if there were, let's say, for example, 10 therapy sessions over 10 weeks versus 10 therapy sessions over 20 weeks, the research that I've at least read prefers 10 sessions over 10 weeks. Is that consistent? Does that make any sense to you? Is this sound right, or would you assume it has no effect?
Right, I don't have any data on that.
Okay,
it sounds plausible in the sense that if you leave too big a gap between the two, let's just talk about 2 sessions to begin with.
Sure.
You have 2 sessions and you leave a big enough gap between it, And if people don't go back and think about what happened in the first session, after a while, things do fade away. We do forget. And that could be a problem. If it's a long period and you're reminded of it, then reminded of the information that you acquired in the first period, you can reacquire it in the second period much more easily than the first time round. But the longer the period of not considering it, I would guess the more practice you're going to need to re-establish what you initially learned. But I'm guessing a little bit there.
Sure. There's some plausibility and it sounds somewhat correct, but it would need to be tested.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
In terms of other items, so repetition is one. I'm assuming that anything that we can connect to a primary information a load will help for it to connect to let me try and rephrase this, my apologies. When trying to uptake novel information, the connections that we can make to any long-term information, would that sort of prime and improve retention rates or more likely would be absorbed?
Yeah, absolutely. Anything that's in long-term memory, whether it was acquired as a primary skill or a secondary skill, if it's up there in long-term memory already, we'll use it. We'll use it automatically. And we don't, and again, that when I say we will use it, I mean we will use it. It's a primary skill. The information, whether it's primary or secondary, we will automatically use it. And that's a primary skill, to use whatever's up in long-term memory. We'll do it easily, automatically. And so you can just assume, okay, if the person I'm dealing with already knows this, I should be able to use it to assist them to acquire whatever new information you want them to acquire. And if the initial information is not in long-term memory, you're probably going to have to do something to ensure that it gets into long-term memory before you proceed.
Does repetition help within a particular time frame? So, for example, in my therapy, there's a concept around acceptance versus avoidance. And that's kind of like leaning into something, not being afraid of it, rather than running away from it. Repetition over weeks, we've covered that. Is there value in repetition with over numerous times within the hour? Let's say 50 minutes, we have 50-minute consults. What does the research say about how we layer that or how we connect that to make that more sticky?
Yeah. Look, there's an effect called the spacing effect, which is a very old effect. It's one of the first effects that was discovered by early experimental psychologists. Spacing does in fact help. I mean, we talked about spacing before and the length of spacing, and I indicated we don't know what the length of spacing should be. Two repetitions, but we know that spacing does work. In other words, if you ask somebody to repeat something twice in succession with no space between it, between the two repetitions, they will learn less than if you have a space. Now, the next obvious question, and in a sense we were talking about that question earlier, is how long should the space be?
Sure.
And we don't really have an answer to that. Certainly, one of the possible answers is if you have sufficient space so that you can have a good rest, including possibly sleeping between the two repetitions, that's beneficial. But certainly having a space where, you know, you don't just ask somebody to, okay, this is what I want you to learn, and now repeat it again. Have a space where, and by a space I mean something where really no complex intellectual activity is going on. Now, currently we just happen to be conducting research on that currently, it's beginning to look like there may be two factors that result in spacing being effective. One factor can be if people go over it in their mind themselves. In other words, spacing may allow you to simply repeat things to yourself and make sure that you understand it. But there may be another factor, and that's that spacing allows working memory to recover. Working memory, it looks like working memory depletes with use and recovers with rest. And spacing gives you a rest.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's something that, you know, you need to learn something that for you is fairly complicated, for your patients, one of our problems is that for you personally, it's not complicated because whatever it is that you're talking about, that you're getting that from your long-term memory, and it's all nice and simple. For your patients, of course, it's not simple. It's much more complicated. And giving them a chance to rest between repetitions, it's certainly positive. We're still debating as to why it's positive, and it looks like it could be positive for two different reasons, at least two different reasons, and one of them is repetition, the other one is recovery from during rest by long-term memory. So from a practical perspective, make sure there's some spacing.
And from a practical perspective, could that spacing be within that 50 minutes, like 10 minutes apart?
Some of the experiments we've done have had spacing of literally something like 10 minutes, yes.
Okay.
So it could work there. And again, it could work, going into this more deeply, it could work that for more complex things, it probably works because the spacing allows working memory recovery.
To rest, yeah.
For less complex things, it's probably because people can go over it in their mind. They can repeat it to themselves.
Okay.
So it depends. If it's something that's complex, and because it's complex, they really haven't reached the point where they can repeat it in their minds, then that repetition effect is not going to work.
Sure.
The recovery due to rest of long-term of working memory should work.
What is meant by complex information? And I ask this obviously because you said we've got to ensure, let's try and mitigate other complex information going on so that you can target moving novel information from working memory to long-term. In therapy, obviously we are often pressing on emotional factors. And to me, at least on the face value perspective, that might potentially add a layer of cognitive load. And I'm not sure whether that's accurate or not. Myself personally, I have found that clients tend to integrate an idea when they're quite emotional. But it's got to be, you know, the environment is great. You know, there is no interruptions. It's private. It's confidential. They can be vulnerable. There's only one conversation occurring. And when they're vulnerable, it tends to open up some sort of channel. Now, this is, you know, anecdotal, so I don't know, and hence why I'm enjoying this conversation. What do we mean by complex information, and how does that relate to emotional states?
Okay. That's actually going to the very core of cognitive load theory, what is meant by complexity. We call it element interactivity. It's not a easy concept, and it's not a concept that in itself is easy to understand. Element interactivity refers to the number of elements of information which we can process simultaneously in working memory. Now, what constitutes an element changes with levels of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at the information, you can divide it up into number of elements. But the difficulty is that when you look at the information that you're dealing with, because of your expertise, because of your experience over a long period of time, you're getting all that information from long-term memory. What constitutes a single element for you may be multiple elements for your patients. And cognitive load theory basically deals with high element interactivity information. That means elements which relate to each other, which have to be associated with each other, and which in your mind as an expert are associated with each other. You've got for any particular syndrome, you've got a single element. That syndrome is a single element for you. Would have taken you many years to turn it into a single element, but it's a single element. It doesn't overwhelm your working memory. You know, you can say, okay, this patient has this particular problem. For your patients, on the other hand, that problem consists of many, many elements, and they're going to have difficulty putting them all together. You don't have to put them all together because you did that years ago. They do. So what I mean by complexity is a combination of the elements of information and the expertise of the person who's dealing with that information. Learning is a in effect an event which reduces element interactivity, because you've got information. It's like, you know, if I show you a set of symbols on a screen or on a board saying the cat sat on the mat. Now, I could show them to you for about 2 or 3 seconds, and I could tell you, okay, you've just seen a whole lot of symbols. Now, repeat those symbols. Write them down. Now, is that a difficult task for you? Well, obviously not. It's a trivial task. If I show exactly the same symbols to somebody for whom English is not either a first language or a language they're highly familiar with, and you repeat the experiment, they won't be able to, you know, that they couldn't do it any more than, for example, if you showed me the same symbols in Chinese which say the cat sat on the mat and asked me to replicate those. Well, I couldn't do it. And that's the point about knowledge held in long-term memory. It completely transforms us.
Yes, yes.
And it's, you know, when you're dealing with your particular cases, exactly the same thing applies.
Absolutely. So element interactivity would somewhat explain, therefore, that, you know, the number of elements of information we can process in our working memory is reduced for people who are depressed because there's more going on from a cognitive load that they're trying to deal with. And that's very well understood. It's a very common experience that people say, I feel foggy, you know, I'm a bit more forgetful, I can't think clearly and reason as well, that there's that going on, plus they are most likely quite poor in their expertise. Even if they were good, they probably aren't in that condition. And so there's two effects going on. And over time is what we're trying to work with them to increase their expertise. But that requires overcoming how we deliver information and how we work with them. And hence why I think therapy often, and it's something that I have to personally deal with all the time because I can get overly excited. Often becomes less, you know, we've got to slow therapy down, you know, this is a very slow and methodical process to ensure it becomes sticky. So the element of being slow obviously paces towards where a client is, but that is important. So emotions often, can emotions be a gateway for opening up learning too?
Yeah. Look, we've just started our research on emotions and cognitive load.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm about to say is in some ways tentative.
Sure.
Where the data is not entirely in. I, in fact, have a PhD student who's working on it right now. There's considerable evidence, yes, if somebody is highly emotional, in effect, what's happening is their working memory is being devoted to things other than what you're attempting to communicate to them. And so it can be difficult for them to assimilate, in other words, to take the material into working memory to transfer it across to long-term memory because they're emotional. But we're getting some evidence that emotions may be beneficial under some circumstances. There's a possibility, and again, I've got to say this tentatively, we don't have enough evidence for it at this point. There may be that rather common psychological effect of the inverted U curve,
mm-hmm.
that as emotion increases, you can take in more and more information. It then flattens out as it increases more.
It overloads.
It overloads. Yeah. So it that may be the case. And of course, when you're dealing with that sort of a phenomenon, and it's just so common in psychology, when you're dealing with that sort of phenomenon, it can be difficult because you really want emotion to be at the peak of that inverted U curve. And it can be fairly difficult to determine exactly when you've reached that peak. I repeat, this is tentative.
Tentative, yeah. There's certainly, from my experience, and yeah, antidotal doesn't stand for anything, but it does seem as though there is some correlation around stickiness, that I call it. For when a client is feeling a certain level of emotion, and certainly not at that flooding point where someone is most certainly overwhelmed. But when they're engaged, and there's a certain level of engagement, you know, it's not usually when someone is angry, for example. But there are times where when there is a sense of being understood, that's not an emotion, but it might be one of safety. There's certainly, from my perspective, when there's a level of hope, so when information is delivered in a way that the client's been validated, they've been understood, you know, we've gone into that sad, difficult space, and now we're starting to open up to hope. There are certain ways that acceptance and commitment therapy can create, I suppose, a condition of curiosity, of intrigue, where you kind of dangle the carrot, but wait for the client to say, well, what is it then? So there's almost like a bit of confusion built in to get them to a yearning, if I can use that language. And obviously there's a delivery as to how that lands, and obviously then reinforcement. You know, there's obviously many interplays there. There's interplays forever, and that's why it's antidotal. We could talk about each of those and segment them forever, and you know, it needs to be done in proper scientific, you know, controlled conditions to say something. But I'm glad there's something at least there, and research is being that there's something potentially there, and research is being considered and starting to examine that more thoroughly.
Yeah. No, look, we have to use anecdotes when we don't have data, but anecdotes can lead to hypotheses and can lead to experiments which can eventually provide data, and we can then go away from the anecdotes. But when the data's not there, then anecdotes can be very valuable.
If we were to design a way of delivery, if we moved across a little bit away from psychology and look at a teaching environment, I think there's lots of commonalities that one can learn from the other. What are the conditions in which you would encourage that would promote learning? What factors should teachers think about, parents, if you will, when we're trying to provide new information, you know, have novel information adopted or put into working memory to obviously be natural, biologically, you know, primarily pushed across long-term memory.
Yeah, okay. Look, there are basically two ways in which we transmit information, certainly in classrooms or in the education sphere. Some of it is orally, and some of it is in written form. Now, in your work, almost much of your work, the information is transmitted orally.
Yes.
Oral information is extremely useful because again, you know, oral information we it's biologically primary. You know, we've evolved to transmit information between ourselves orally. But we need to keep in mind why writing was invented in the first place. The peculiarity of oral communication is it's transient.
Yes, yes.
You know, what you and I have been, you know, we're dealing in oral communication right now, and what we've been talking about for the last 3/4 of an hour or so, in a way, that's gone. I mean, it's being recorded, and the reason it's being recorded is precisely because oral information disappears. It's transient.
Mm. Digital long-term memory, the recording, yes.
Yeah, exactly. That's that we use that as a substitute for long-term memory, having a recording. But that's also why we invented writing. Written information is permanent. Okay, you read something and say, oh, that's interesting. I don't quite understand it. Let me read it again. You can do that with complicated written information, not nearly as easy to do with oral information. You can do it to some extent now because of recordings. You can go back to the recording. But it's not the same. And, you know, intuitively we all feel, look, you know, if you're dealing with something like mathematics, for example, you know, mathematics was just, it's impossible without written information. It's got to be in writing because it's very high in element interactivity. And until you can have stuff written down, there's no mathematics, essentially. Mathematics depended on the invention of writing and, you know, mathematical symbols. You deal almost entirely with oral information. You talk to people. But you may want to consider that if some of the material you're presenting to them is complicated, high in element interactivity, you may want to consider presenting them with information, some of the information in written form, so they can take it away and think about it themselves. I'm not a clinical psychologist, so I'm not, you know, talking about expertise. this is information that you're better equipped to deal with than I am. But you may want to consider presenting information to at least some of your patients, depending on the nature of the information and the nature of the patient. You may want to consider not only just presenting it in oral form, but also presenting in written form. Because that written information, if they couldn't assimilate it, if it's complicated, and again, you know, none of it is terribly complicated for you because of your expertise.
Sure.
But if it's complicated for them, you may want to consider writing something out for them indicating, look, this is what we're doing and this is what I'd like you to do. That's important. It's similar, it's identical in some ways to the clinical medical situation. It's one thing for doctors to talk to their patients, but mostly, if you go into a complex medical situation, the medico will present you with some of the information in written form because it really is too complex. In medical situations, it may not be all that important that the patient understand what's going on. In your situation, it's absolutely critical.
Mm.
Would have guessed, you know, the patient really needs to understand what's going on. And sometimes you may want to consider presenting some of that information in written form. I mean, it depends on the patient. I mean, some of your patients' levels of reading and writing ability is may make it difficult to present the information in written form. But if you've got a patient for whom who really can read and write well, you may seriously want to consider presenting some of the information sometimes in written form.
That makes a lot of sense, John, because thinking about it, although oral is our primary method of information delivery, written in the form of, for example, providing a worksheet or a book that someone can read on much more thoroughly, it also immediately factors in the cognitive architecture. So it creates for repetition as a possibility. It creates yep. for a spacing effect. It allows for recovery time of the working memory. And, you know, if those are introduced, it therefore means that over time, there's an increase in the expertise of the client, which means they could potentially take on more of the information should they return to it again, because the cognitive load is also the element interactivity has gone down, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. And he even in some cases, using diagrams may be helpful as well. Yes. I mean, diagrams, again, we invented diagrams because diagrams can help us understand relations between things sometimes better than language. And sometimes, you know, language can cover most things, but again, we invented writing, we invented diagrams because sometimes things are better covered in those forms.
I've heard of submodalities in trying to learn, and that's certainly speaking to that, in that someone might be quite visual, and you know, we do this in our IQ testing, obviously, in terms of comprehension strengths that we have, and some are going to be much more visual, others are going to be more verbal, and the like. And so by layering it, it at least provides the opportunity to lean into where someone might be strong. And that doesn't mean that it's not effective in the other, but there's a limitation in that for some. So diagrams I can see as being helpful as well. And interestingly, while we're speaking, because this is also novel, well, at least some of it is, I'm writing all the time. So as I'm speaking to you, I'm looking at my sheets and looking at where's that information that I wrote down. What's this? Oh, element interactivity. I've written that down, and I've got a kind of a diagram there that tells me how they interact.
That's exactly it. It's why students take notes. You know, the notes are permanent. The lecture itself is transient, and the transient information effect is one of the major cognitive load theory effects, that complex material cannot really be presented in transient form. It has to be transformed into permanent form, because one needs to keep going over it, and that's a relevant consideration.
How does interest moderate learning? I'm thinking of a scenario where many people could anecdotally talk about an interest that they had in a subject, and that the lecturer, the teacher was wonderful, and they got along with them quite well, and so it that the stars aligned and they became very proficient at it. And, you know, part of my mind says, well, maybe there's a factor there in terms of how the information was presented and experienced. It wasn't boring. It, you know, maybe cognitive load goes down when there's an interest in it. The other side of me tells you, if you are interested in all those things have a line, you're much more likely to do repetition. You're much more likely to have the spacing effect. You're engaged and maybe attending, your working memory is more activated because your attention level is not dealing with boredom or frustrations or whatever it means that's going on. How do those interplay?
Yeah, they're closely connected. You're now talking about motivation rather than cognition. There've been a lot of people who've tried to integrate motivation with cognition, and specifically with cognitive load theory. And there's no question, everything you said is it sounds absolutely valid. Can't tell you much about it because so far we don't know enough about motivation to be able to connect it closely with cognition. I mean, the cognitive load theory has simply made the assumption, which is obviously not correct in some circumstances, made the assumption that the person who's assimilating the information is motivated to assimilate it.
Mm-hmm.
But the real question then becomes, well, okay, how do we increase that motivation? How do we make somebody motivated? Because we know, you can present, you've got a patient, and if that patient is not motivated to listen to you, to try to assimilate the information you're presenting, it doesn't matter how you present it or what you do. If they're not motivated, your therapy is simply not going to work because they're basically not going to listen to you. And in a way, I guess your assumption is also the person is motivated. But the question you're now asking, well, how do I get them to be motivated? How do I motivate them? And we really don't have any proper answers to that at present.
Why psychologists often lean into emotions as being motivators. That's what I think, and even in therapy, at least in acceptance and commitment therapy, there is a lightheartedness component of therapy to not just make it serious, but that they can have some lightheartedness, they can have a joke in the middle of it, it can go out, and maybe that creates a little bit of a recovery time as well. There's an element of making it enjoyable as well that potentially leans into what you're talking about. And in actual fact, motivation is separate to cognitive architecture. Cognitive architecture just is, and then motivation really asks how much are you going to use of that cognitive architecture in terms of repetition. This is why we don't stick children into university, into any course. They choose the course they want to, so they will attend to it even when it's hard.
Yeah. Look, there's one other factor here when talking about these issues, which is relevant and for which there's data available. We've sort of assumed, and in what I've said just a few seconds ago, that motivation affects cognition. In other words, if you're motivated, you'll engage in cognitive activities. If you're not motivated, you won't engage in them. I assume that has to be correct, but it also works in the opposite direction. You will find that if your patient's cognitive load is reduced, and if they find, look, this is, I really understand what's being said here, and it's really important to me, and I'm assimilating it, that affects motivation. Somebody who may not be motivated, and we actually have data on that, you reduce cognitive load, you'll increase motivation. So it's an interaction between the two. It's a complex interaction. And we naturally move towards the idea, yeah, motivation affects cognition, but cognition affects motivation as well. If you're looking at something and, gee, I've no idea what's going on here. I can't understand it. This is really difficult. You're going to lose motivation. So it works in that direction as well. On the other hand, if you're listening to, if your patient is listening to you and saying, oh, wow, I understand that. That's new to me and it's clear and it makes sense and I can use this. That cognitive effect results in a motivational effect. So it goes in both directions.
I can see how this is all playing into. I had a guest recently talking about students' motivation and engagement and learning. And we crossed over to the movement from direct teaching through to indirect exploratory sort of curious teaching and how the pendulum has swung and at least it seemed like we landed on that there's a move coming back to direct teaching because some of the skills that we're seeing in at least the national assessments are not showing what we want them to in terms of literacy and numeracy and so on, that they do require a certain amount of direct teaching, because if we're doing it with ambiguity, with an explorative, we are potentially increasing the cognitive load because there's no expert knowledge in it to build on.
Absolutely.
And so now teaching, I think, is starting to understand that and come back to more direct at least aspects of more direct teaching. Is that your understanding?
Yeah. I'm heavily involved in that entire movement. We've had almost two generations of an emphasis in education on inquiry-based learning rather than explicit teaching.
John, sorry to jump in. You must have been horrified watching this.
Look, when it first came, I looked at it and said, no, look, I can ignore this. Nobody's going to be silly enough to follow this. And I woke up a few years later and realized it's an entire movement which has taken over. And it took the results from international tests to finally convince people, stop, we've got to go in a different direction. And the data for randomized controlled trials, I mean, right from the beginning of cognitive load theory, we looked at the difference between having people learn by solving problems as opposed to having them learn by studying worked examples. In other words, exactly the same problem with the answer and with the answer indicating how to solve the problem. It's called the worked example effect. It works in mathematics, which is a lot of the research was carried out there, but it works everywhere. Even teaching people how to write essays, they're better off in the first instance looking at an ideal essay. That'll teach them how to write essays. And in effect, what you're doing is you're providing people with information. That's, when you're talking to them, that's at least part of what you're doing. And you wouldn't say, oh, look, this is the problem. go away and figure out the answer yourself, because if you figure it out yourself, it's better than if I tell you what the answer is. Humans, talking biologically primary and secondary, we have the reason humans are the dominant mammalian species on Earth is precisely because we can transmit enormous amounts of information between us. It's what you and I are doing right now. No other species can do that. And all of a sudden we found in education people saying, oh, no, don't tell people what the answer is. Let them work it out themselves. And can we learn that way? Yeah, of course we can learn that way. Sometimes it can take you 5 years to figure out something that you, if somebody shows you, you can literally learn it in a few minutes. I mean, the reason we conduct research is because there's nobody there to give us the answers. We have to work it out ourselves. If there's somebody who can give us the answers, once we find the answer, you know, we frequently find, oh, look, this is obvious. It's simple. That's only once we found the answer. It's no way to conduct education. And I suspect, and again, I emphasize, I'm not a clinical psychologist. I suspect it's no way to conduct clinical therapy, but I'll leave that to people like you who actually know what you're talking about with respect to clinical psychology.
No, I think you're right. There is still some of a balance there where I think anecdotally psychologists would generally say, you know, assisting a client find the answer. But the psychologist is very much guiding the direction for that penny to drop, so to speak. If they're told just very directly, I think that element of motivation, intrigue, the curiosity, the hope that's built from that, putting the pieces together. And because it's slow and methodical, hopefully it's not overwhelming the working memory. But if they don't find it, I think it still is imperative in the psychologist's role to help them find that. And hence why we do time our sessions, you know, about will I introduce this right now or do we leave it to the next session? It might be also that we tend to, we could potentially overwhelm the working memory as well by just providing more. There's only a certain amount that a client could potentially take on and then work on between sessions to do the repetition, to do the spacing effect, to have recovery time and so on.
That really leads to another cognitive load theory effect called the expertise reversal effect. What we find, and there's a lot of data supporting what I'm about to say, when somebody's a novice, really doesn't know a great deal, the best way for them to learn is to be provided with the information. As they get more and more information, after a while, you need to shift from providing them with information to having them practicing using the information and thinking about the information. So you go from providing information explicitly, directly,
yes,
and continuously until they've reached a level of now needing to practice that information themselves. It's like, again, in education, you provide people with worked examples of either problems or essays or whatever. But you can't stop there. At some point, they have to start practicing that themselves. They have to start practicing solving the problems, practicing writing the essays. That's when you start leaving them alone. In other words, you don't just say, oh, okay, I'm going to get you to study writing essays, and that's all I'm ever going to do.
And that makes all the sense in the world, in that, you know, we tend to scaffold from that psychoeducation, what we call it, which is the direct teaching. And then it moves through to the expert reversal effect of running experiments. So, you know, clients are then encouraged between sessions to run an experiment. You know, I don't like to use homework because that word we tend to frown away from.
That connects up to schools, and they may want to forget schools.
Absolutely. But if we're running an experiment, there's a bit of curiosity there. There's hopefully some examination of it, and it's not an ongoing demand, you know. And if you run the experiment, then great. And if you don't, no biggie. But where we do have that experiment, I think that's where we tend to integrate so much learning. You know, we've got firsthand information that tends to be really sticky. And maybe that's because of some of these other things, that repetition has occurred. There's been the direct teaching beforehand, that maybe the complex information, it doesn't feel as complex because some was integrated through their expertise. The fact that they've done the experiment gives them some information that's now in the long-term memory store, because that's probably, I'm assuming, that's a biologically primary thing to remember. Something they've done tends to go in a bit more. We tend to remember things that we've done, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Well, that's been my experience.
doing things yourself.
Yeah.
Helps the memory to develop. But getting the memory there in the first place, you know, it's better to watch somebody else do it, in effect, or have somebody else tell you how to do it. Once it's all been explained, then you start repeating it, and the memory is established even more strongly.
Mm-hmm. Are you shifting gears a little bit? Are you hopeful that the work that you're currently doing and that you've been part of will change our school system to be more directive now that that is fairly clear, that's understood? Are we almost there? Are we definitely there and we're rolling it out? Where do you see we are in this trajectory?
We're rolling it out. It's okay. Literally in the last few months, things have changed. They've changed dramatically here in Australia. They changed much earlier in England. One of the peculiarities of cognitive load theory is that it was advocated for and adopted in England some years ago. And the English, and I mean English rather than United Kingdom, it didn't happen in Scotland or Wales or Northern Ireland. The English system changed, and the change came about because politicians and bureaucrats insisted on it coming about in England, and the same thing is happening here. We've just had ministers of education who have, and that's the state ministers and the federal minister of education last year, more or less mandated that you can't just eliminate explicit instruction. You can't just base it all on inquiry learning. And cognitive load theory is becoming far more central here in Australia. There are several reasons for that, but it's now happened. It's interesting. I spent my whole career pushing for this, and I'm now in my late 70s. And it's finally happened. I think the answer is you've got to live a long time. Anyway, look, cognitive load theory was adopted internationally well before it was adopted here in Australia, but it's now happened here in Australia.
There are some other positive signs. I think that removal of telephones is becoming more and more widespread. Having said that, I think that's a big fight.
That's going to be a massive fight, but
it's going to be fascinating to see how AI plays into this, because all of a sudden, while we've been talking, I've been thinking about Google has been phenomenal and amazing as a long-term memory store, but finding those long-term memories has been a bit of a hassle. And the advent of AI is beginning to make less friction in that process, and that accessibility, I think it will change and in actual fact potentially make us much our capacity is much greater, in that we could potentially become experts faster in areas with the accessibility. We just ask it in a verbal, oral way, and it can tell us in an oral way. We're open to that information. It can be at our fingertips. The next 50 years is I think going to be a mystery. It's a mystery at the moment, but it's going to be exciting for many ways. But I can see both lots of exciting and unintended interesting things occurring. So that's going to be a fascinating one.
Exactly, yes. Well, AI allows us to communicate with machinery in the same way we communicate with each other. And that's interesting.
Nice way to put it. Nice way to put it. John, where can listeners find out more if we want to continue this conversation and learn more about this? I don't listen to any of my podcasts after they're done. This one I will most certainly be listening to, because there's so much for me to, I think, come back on. And even though this is only a bit of a scaffolding and a framework, I can already see how I could apply my therapy in a very different way, and how I can also engage with my children differently as well in all those teaching opportunities, both direct and exploratory. Where can people find out more about your work, others' work in this field? I know that you're incredibly well published, and your contributions have been phenomenal. Where could you point listeners to?
Look, the best way of finding out about cognitive load theory is unless you're a psychologist working in the area, don't read my stuff. There are some terrific books out there now on cognitive load theory written by other people. Here in Australia, the two major authors are Greg Ashman and the other one is Ollie Lovell. So both of them have written terrific books on cognitive load theory.
Greg Ashman and Holly Lovell.
Ollie
Lovell, sorry.
Ollie.
Love it. Wonderful, wonderful. I think they're good starting points. And if you're a bit more academic minded, then obviously we can move across to your works.
Well, those books cite my work, so if somebody's, as you say, more academically oriented, they can they can look at the original papers. You really need a background in psychology to be able to understand them properly. But those books, and there are international books as well on cognitive load theory, but here in Australia, they're the ones written by two Australian authors.
Before I let you go, John, what are your hopes for the future and cognitive load theory? Where do you hope it goes, how it's integrated? What would you like to see?
Look, what I'm seeing now, for decades I was putting out stuff on cognitive load theory and sitting back and waiting for something to happen, and it was like putting it out to outer space. Nothing happened. It's all happening now. It's really strange how something that was ignored literally for decades suddenly became popular. I don't know the possibly people who are more attuned to what's happening in society are able to explain that more clearly than I am, but what's happening now, I'm happy with what's happening now. So it's
maybe I'm fanciful here, but I'd like to think that logic and reasoning and scientific inquiry, we come back to it. It makes sense. We might lose our way along the way. However, the outcomes eventually get questioned, and then we go back to what we originally did or forgot, or we said it was too hard to apply. Well, the other version is too hard to live with, and so I'm glad that in your lifetime you've got to see the fruits of your labor, because I really appreciate what you've provided to the world in a very genuine way, and I'm appreciative of you and your time today. But it's amazing to have access in this modern world to have this conversation and for it to be recorded. I will go back to this, and for me this has been inspiring. It gives me more curiosity and clues and questions around how am I doing my therapy, how am I layering it, how am I staggering it. I'm certainly going to be providing more book recommendations, and I'm certainly going to be doing continuing on with my diagrams, and I think I'll develop my own worksheets so I can deliver them as an adjunct to the work that I do in my sessions. So there's plenty more that I can uncover here. So yeah, thank you for your contribution and for your time today. It's been absolute pleasure to have you on.
And it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you again for inviting me. This has been a great interview. Thank you very, very much.